This morning, I opened my email, and one of the first things I saw was from Barnes & Noble Bookstores, and they had their top picks of the new year, and one of the two books under the category Riveting History was the book written by our next guest, Deva Sobel. She's with us by phone today. She's the award-winning science reporter, the author of many books, including Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, and Is Anyone Out There?, the latter co-authored with astronomer Frank Drake. And her latest book is called The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And we'll be talking with her about the discoveries these women made and the importance of women's contribution to science. And you may have some questions or even experiences to share with Deva. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at talk@wpr.org or post questions or comments on our Facebook page, The Larry Miller Show. Deva Sobel, welcome to the program. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Happy to be here.
Well, I really enjoyed your book. It was so much fun. And I see your author with a co-author on another book with the father of Nadia Drake. And Nadia Drake was the science writer in residence here at the UW-Madison a few months ago, and I interviewed Nadia and had a wonderful time with her.
Oh, she's lovely.
She really is. You're very involved in science through your work. What got you interested in writing about it?
Writing about science?
Yeah.
I think my first opportunity came, I'm very old, with the first Earth Day. I was writing for a newspaper in upstate New York, and in the run-up to Earth Day, I was writing features about pollution and conservation and preparations for Earth Day, and I didn't even know it was called science writing at that point, but I was happy to have discovered that occupation.
I bet you were. And I teach here at the University of Wisconsin in the Department of Life Sciences Communication, so we have an emphasis on that, which drew me to your book for sure. Tell us about the women of Harvard Observatory and how did they become part of the organization?
At first, they were literally born into it because most of the early women assistants were the sisters, daughters, sometimes the wives of the resident astronomers. So they were on the premises and they were taught how to do the work of the observatory. And that worked out so well that women from outside began to be hired. And in 1877, so this is a long time ago. People tend to think that women in science is a new event, but these women were working in the late 19th century when Edward Pickering took over the observatory. He got a big grant from a woman, an heiress, to conduct a huge astronomy project, and that enabled him to hire as many as 15 to 20 women at a time working at the observatory looking at beautiful photographs on glass plates that gave them a deep view of the heavens, even more detailed than could be seen through the telescope in real time.
It was amazing. And Anna Draper certainly deserves a lot of credit.
Yes, she was the funder of the project. She had hoped to do the work herself with her husband, Henry Draper. They had organized their lives to be able to devote themselves full-time to astronomy. He had the ability in many fields. He was trained as a doctor, but he was a passionate amateur astronomer, and she shared that passion with him and fortunately inherited a large fortune from her father. So she was willing to underwrite his dreams. And just when they were prepared to do that, he died suddenly at age 45. And she turned the money over to Edward Pickering at Harvard so that he could see her husband's work to completion. And all she asked in return was that he name the project the Henry Draper Memorial, which he was happy to do.
Yeah, and the... I guess there are a couple of things going on here. They were, although it was at Harvard, there was, if I'm not mistaken, they were pretty independent in many ways from Harvard itself. And so he had a lot of freedom, I guess, in who he hired.
Yes. The observatory was an independent entity. It was affiliated with Harvard, but the day-to-day operation was completely under Pickering's control. And on the downside, the observatory got no money from Harvard. So he was also duty-bound to raise money, and that's why Mrs. Draper's gift was such a boon.
Talk a little bit more about what these women did, and maybe describe it a little more for us. They were called computers.
Yes, at first they were really doing computing work. So most observatories at that period were ascertaining the positions of the heavenly bodies, the orbits of the planets, the paths of comets, and the exact positions of the stars. This was very important for navigation. So the observations of the stars had to be mathematically corrected for things like the distortion of the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere, and also the Earth's motion in space. So there was a lot of math to be applied to the observations. But once the photographs started to be taken, then the women were doing something else in addition to charting the heavens. They were determining the chemical composition of the stars. This was all a mystery at the in the late 19th century. What were the stars made of? What gave them the ability to generate their heat and light? How far away were they? All of these were open questions, and by the end of the story, I'm happy to tell you, or if you already know, the answers had been figured out.
Yeah, it's just an amazing story, and I like the fact Barnes & Noble called it riveting history, because it really is, to me, a riveting read. And I have a 13-year-old daughter, and hanging on to that book. I don't know that she's quite ready, but in another year or so, I want her to read this book, because it's a kind of a great history of, in many ways, of women in science at a very tough time for, frankly, for women in the field of higher education.
Yes, it was thought then that college was bad for girls and that a higher education might actually interfere with a woman's ability to bear children. And Pickering thought that was nonsense. And so in addition to hiring women, and he brought in a lot of women who were graduates of the new women's colleges like Wellesley and Vassar and Smith, and he also put out a general appeal to the alumni of those colleges, urging them, if they were interested in astronomy, to participate from home with their own small telescopes and to send their observations to Harvard, where they would be collated and published. And he got a lot of cooperation that way, volunteer cooperation.
It was an amazing story. There are three or four women that I wouldn't mind zeroing in a little bit on, because I found them interesting. A couple of them have Wisconsin ties, which drew me to them a little bit. Miss Leavitt, and even Miss Maury had some Wisconsin, lived in Wisconsin for a time. If I'm not mistaken, I believe I read that in your book. But one of the most intriguing ones to me was Mrs. Fleming, Wilhelmina Fleming, who was first a maid, I believe. She came from Scotland to America, did she not?
Yes, she did. And she applied for the maid's job at the observatory because she was pregnant and her husband had disappeared, and she was in a desperate condition. But Pickering realized very quickly that she was intelligent and good at math, and so he put her to work in the observatory instead of in the residence. And she went back to Scotland to have her baby, and she was so grateful to Pickering that she named the baby Edward Charles Pickering Fleming. And then she came back. He promised her a job if she would return. And she came back and became the first woman to hold a Harvard University title as curator of astronomical photographs. She also brought her son over when he was about 7 and put him all the way through school. He was a graduate of MIT and became a mining engineer. So she was not only a woman in astronomy, but she was a single working mother, which was highly unusual.
And someone who in her own right, developed some things that were fantastic.
Yes, she made one of the first systematic classifications of the stars. And from her examination of the photographs, she discovered 10 novae, so-called new stars, and many variable stars. And she was world famous in her own lifetime.
Amazing person. I want to say amazing, amazing woman. I'll amend that to amazing, amazing person, Wilhelmina Fleming. Well, tell us a little bit more. You know, that time, it was such a different time compared to now in so many ways for women, although there are still, I guess, some glass ceilings when it comes to women in science.
Yes, but these women were given an extraordinary opportunity. And although they were paid less than men doing the same work, they had intellectual freedom and they were given full credit for their discoveries, which I think was also very unusual.
Very unusual. Talking today with Dava Sobel, who is the author of the book, The Glass Universe. I highly recommend it to you. She'll be with us right up until about 12:30 today. We're going to take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guest. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking today with noted science writer Dava Sobel about her new book. It's based on the remarkable women who worked at Harvard Observatory and really expanded our knowledge of the universe and whose discoveries, in fact, are still being used today. This was started in the late 19th century, and the book kind of goes through not to the present time, but closer to the present time. And it's a remarkable book. I really enjoyed reading it and can highly recommend it to you. You may have questions about the book itself. You may have questions about the role of women in science and their recognition. I hope you'll join in. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Do you think it's important to get young girls interested in science? How do we do that? What ideas do you have? Join in, and we'd love to hear from you. These women, the work they did, I certainly, I'm not talented enough to do it for one thing, nor do I think I'd have the patience. Could you describe for us, Dava, how they worked?
Oh, it did take tremendous patience. One project involved looking at the same group of stars over a period of time. So comparing photographs over days, weeks, months, years, change in brightness in the stars. So imagine a picture with a few thousand dots on it, and you're looking at them and identifying each one and seeing whether it is brighter or dimmer than it was in the other photograph you examined. So not for everyone, this kind of work. But important discoveries came out of it. One of the most significant discoveries, in fact, came from working with variable stars in a group of stars visible only from the southern hemisphere. So early on, Pickering realized that he would have to cover the entire sky, not just what could be seen from Cambridge. And he sent an emissary to South America to go camping and hiking and pick out a great spot. And they set up a southern satellite station near the town of Arequipa, Peru. And from there, again, photographs all through the night, every clear night. And there were a lot more clear nights in Arequipa than in Cambridge. And so Henrietta Leavitt, examining these photographs, looking at the way stars changed, made a very interesting observation that led to a distance scale. Until then, there had been no way to gauge very great distances in space. But she noticed that a certain type of variable star in this grouping changed its time of variation according to how bright it really was. And that observation led to a calibration of these stars, and they are still used today as what astronomers call standard candles for helping to judge distances in space. And it was that observation and those calibrations that Edwin Hubble used when he made the discovery that there were galaxies beyond our Milky Way galaxy. Up till that point, many astronomers thought that the galaxy was the universe, that the Milky Way contained everything. And Hubble was able to show that, no, those little spiral things that people thought were part of the Milky Way were actually separate galaxies. And a few years later, he used those same stars and calibrations to determine that the universe was expanding.
It's amazing. And Henrietta Leavitt, by the way, was from Beloit, if I'm not mistaken.
She spent a few years at Beloit College as an art assistant.
Very, very interesting. George in Wanakee has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, George. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. This story fascinates me, and it is tickling my memory of either a movie or a TV dramatization of this story. I remember clearly,
yes, you're right,
women working in a lab with glass plates placed over the observations coming from the observatory lenses. And the dramatization also depicted a significant conflict between what it seemed to be a male overseer and then the various women working there, and ultimately the women prevailed and triumphed. Am I accurate in that?
I believe you're remembering an episode from the recent remake of Cosmos. Did you watch the Neil Tyson-hosted version?
I did, yes.
So it was episode 8. It was called Sisters of the Sun, and it was about these women. And I believe the conflict concerned Cecilia Payne, who was a British graduate student. She was one of the first graduate students at Harvard. And there was an interesting legacy there because of all the money donated to the project by women. Fellowships were set up to enable young women to come and spend a year working at the observatory, and then they could go on to jobs at other observatories. And when Pickering died and the new director took over, that was Harlow Shapley, he wanted to set up a program in graduate education to make Harvard a place where astronomers could not just do the work of astronomy, but also get an astronomy education. And the only fellowship money he had was this fund for women, specifically earmarked for women. So all of the early graduate students
were women.
And the first PhD was this woman, Cecilia Payne, who came from England because she had been advised that there was no future for her in astronomy in England, and she should try to get to Harvard. So she got one of these fellowships, and in the course of writing her doctoral dissertation, she was looking at the relative abundance of different elements in the stars. And it kept coming out that hydrogen was about a million times more prevalent than anything else. And her advisor, who was also the director, Shapley, was worried about that finding because it was so contrary to the received wisdom of the day. So he wanted her to temper it. He also showed her result to the reigning authority, who was Henry Norris Russell, who also said, it's just impossible. But because she had called attention to the situation, Russell was open-minded and kept and did follow-up work, and it took only 4 years for him to say, you know what, it really is hydrogen.
It really is.
Yeah.
There was an interesting side story with her as well when she was in Russia, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yes. She traveled extensively to see the observatories in Northern Europe. This was after a disastrous love affair that just left her brokenhearted. So she decided to take this trip, and she visited Russia at a terrible time in the country's history. So the people were really starving, and she was wondering how she could help them. And from Russia, she went to an astronomy meeting in Germany, where she met a Russian emigre, an astronomer who had been studying and working in Germany. He had just lost his job, and he was desperate. He couldn't go back to Russia because the Russians thought he was a German spy, and in Germany he was under Nazi surveillance. And she managed to get him invited to Harvard.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And they wound up
married him.
Yeah, and they wound up getting married, yeah. much to the surprise of the other folks at the at Harvard.
Right.
It was a great story. George, thank you so much for calling. I'm going to have to. I did not see that NOVA presentation. I'm going to have to look that.
It was the Cosmos.
Oh, the Cosmos. I'm sorry.
The original Carl Sagan series from the 70s was reimagined by the original writers. With a new host, Neil deGrasse Tyson from the Hayden Planetarium in New York. And they added this episode about the Harvard women.
Yeah.
But they were done in cartoon form. There's also a movie coming out about a group of African-American women who worked at Langley in Virginia as computers and who were segregated, so they were called colored computers. And the movie's called Hidden Figures, and it's based on a book of the same name.
Oh, interesting. George, thank you again. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. You know, we're still benefiting from the work done at the Harvard University, and that was the late 1800s, early 1900s. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So another woman who came in the 1890s, Annie Jump Cannon, she took on this challenge of classifying the stars, there had to be a taxonomy of the heavens, just the way we classify animals, plants. And she took on that work and was extremely talented at it. Other people had worked on it. Other women in the group had begun that work. But she really took it over and, again, became world famous in her own lifetime, receiving honorary membership in foreign astronomical societies. And the classification had started out with just letters of the alphabet as names. So there were A stars, B stars, C stars. And the way she reworked the system, the alphabetical order disappeared. So it wound up O, B, A, F, G, K, M. And if you're wondering how I can remember that string of letters...
That's a great name.
There's a very a mnemonic grew up around the system, which astronomy students to this day learn in the first semester of astronomy, which is, oh, be a fine girl, kiss me.
I love that.
They say, oh, be a fine guy. But that was very much a product of Miss Cannon's work. And I refer to them as Miss Cannon, Miss Leavitt.
I was going to ask you about that.
That's how they spoke about each other, and that's how Pickering always spoke about them. Things got a little more casual when Shapley took over, but it was not uncommon for people who worked together 30 or 40 years to keep up an extreme level of politeness. I mean, they were close friends. They were at work together 6 days a week, and then they socialized together on Saturday night. This was a family.
Yeah, and as you point out, they stayed. They didn't leave. And those positions were highly sought after.
Yes, yes. And at the beginning, if a woman got married, then she left the observatory. But it didn't happen often. And later, it was more acceptable to stay on as a working wife, especially as many of the marriages at the observatory were between staff members. So it was even more of a family.
Yeah. We haven't mentioned very much Miss Maury, Antonia Maury. She lived in Wisconsin. She came and went, but was certainly instrumental at... she was assigned what? The spectra of the brightest northern stars. And
yes.
She devised a classification system as well.
Yes, she did. She was the niece of Henry Draper. And she was the first one to come to the observatory with a college education. So she was a Vassar graduate and extremely intelligent and well-prepared for her work. And she devised an extremely complex system, which Miss Cannon thought was too complicated, and she simplified. But some of the distinctions that Antonia Maury put in her system actually turned out to be essential determinants of the intrinsic brightness of the stars. And so her distinctions have been restored to the classification system. The way the classification system functions now, it uses the letters and the subscripts of Annie Jump Cannon, but it also includes parts of Antonia Maury's system.
It's another amazing woman, and she sort of came and went.
Yes, she... She had a rough time. She felt very criticized by Pickering. She was a slow worker. She worked hard and she did important things, but he was intent on getting things published and out into the world so that other scientists could use them. That was a main thrust of his, that everything should be published and made available to anyone else interested in the subject. He was even that way personally. He invented several important machines, including an early version of the telephone, but he never patented anything because he felt that scientists should share information. So he pressured her to work faster than she was comfortable doing, and so sometimes she quit for a while, but she always came back.
The glass plates, I do want to mention them again, because those plates, even though they were made to begin with way back,
some of them are definitely from the 1880s, but there are recent ones too, right up through the 1980s. So it's really a century of the sky, and the plates are all still held at Harvard. There are 500,000 of them. It is still in the building that was expressly constructed to hold them.
That is an amazing, amazing story, just in and of itself, that those, and they're still very valuable.
Yes. Well, that is the glass universe, and they are so valuable, in fact, that they are being digitized now because scientists want to consult them when a new discovery is made. It's important to look back and see if there's evidence at an earlier date, and there simply is no other resource comparable to this collection of glass plates. So they have value, and once they're digitized, then people won't have to travel to Harvard to look at them. In Pickering's day, he used to send the plates to people who were interested. That isn't done anymore. They're too fragile, too valuable. But people do come to look at them. And the equipment for the digitization all had to be created specially for this task. The plates also have to be cleaned before they're digitized. And that involves removing the notations on them. A lot of it was standard practice to circle things on the plates that looked interesting and should be followed up by somebody else, or to write down the brightnesses of certain objects. So they photograph the plates with the markings, then they clean them, and then they put them through the scanner.
Amazing work. Well, the other person I just wanted to mention for sure, the other woman that I wanted to mention was Catherine Wolfe Bruce, because she also plays a big role.
Yes, another heiress who stepped forward when Pickering wanted to build the telescope for his station in South America. She wrote him a check for $50,000. She was in her 70s, and she had become seriously interested in astronomy and wanted to do as much good as she could. So not only did she pay for that telescope, but then she asked Pickering to help her find other astronomers who needed money, even small amounts, whatever they needed to hire an assistant or make a repair, publish some results, whatever it was. And she funded the beginning of the journal, the Astrophysical Journal. And her name, she also endowed a medal, a Lifetime Achievement Award for astronomers, which is called the Bruce Medal, and which is still awarded.
It an amazing story. It must have been fun to write this.
Oh, I just love this story. I felt so close to these women. There were diaries to read, letters. The time came alive for me.
I can believe that, and I really enjoyed reading the book. And
I'm so glad.
I so much appreciate you taking time to be with us today. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope we have a chance to talk again.
I hope so, too.
Thank you, Dave.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Dava Sobel, the book is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And we have a link on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show for the book and more about Dava Sobel as well. It's a wonderful read. And I thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll stay with us because there's lots more in store on the Ideas Network.